Greetings to each one. Appreciate the privilege to be here again this morning and share together. I just heard an account that as we were discussing in the Sunday school class, the Sunday school lesson, that really struck a chord in my heart. One of our ministering brethren at home has a sister that walked away from the faith. And he's commented to me already about how she can go against so much of what she was taught. Well, that sister of his had a daughter. And the daughter married a divorced man. So as now this couple is older. The daughter and her husband was in a former marriage relationship. But her daughter and her husband began to read the Bible, to study it, which is a tremendous blessing. And they came across these scriptures on divorce and remarriage. And what are they to do with these scriptures? The gentleman asked his mother-in-law, "Did you know this? Did you know the Bible taught against remarriage?" "Well, yes, she did, but she tried to make excuse for it. You know, these verses that they come up with, you know, saving for the cause of fornication and all this and all the excuses." But he looked at her and said, "The Bible teaches that it's sin." Mother-in-law and father-in-law knew it. Now, their daughter and son-in-law have to deal with it. And I just wonder, how could you go to bed and think that because of your antichrist spirit, your daughter and son-in-law have to deal with the Bible truth that you tried to deny as authentic? So this morning, I have an assignment coming up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, that I'm going to use on you today, and I want you to tell me how to perfect it. I feel a little nervous, you know, me, this simple fellow spent so many 20 years in Central America teaching the truth to the mountain people, now be invited to Lancaster County for a message, and I am or three messages in fact, and you know, how do I handle this? But I'm just thankful that we have the Word of God. I'm going to share thoughts that have been going through my mind, and if it sounds a little bit disorderly. I'm going to use you as a sounding board how to put it in order. So bear with me. Number one, I do not like to preach and leave throughout the message a negative sound. The messages the three messages that I'm asked to preach are family related, and the one is families dealing with negative influences or standing against wrong pressures. I'm not inclined to go into all these negative pressures and try to tell you how to stay away from them. But we hear these things. Everyone is doing it. Everyone is doing it. Or maybe it's just the most popular people that are doing it. But it has an influence, it has an effect. I don't know. Maybe it's more of a girl thing than it is a boy thing. I don't know. What's wrong with it? Did you ever hear that? What's wrong with it? Why does it matter? Bible doesn't say anything about it. Then, if it can be just wiped aside so easily, why is it causing a conflict? There's really nothing wrong with it. The Bible doesn't say anything wrong with it. Where's the source of conflict? Why is it attractive? Those are some things that go through my mind as I consider. And there's so much information available today that I think we become too adept at just blotting out what we don't want to hear and listening to what we do want to hear. It brings three questions to my mind. Who are we serving? Who is important to us? What is important to us? Is comfort more important than obedience? Is popularity more important than truth? Is sin easier than surrender? When your love isn't right, you will be comfortable with what God condemns. When your love isn't right, there are so many things that, after all, are acceptable. How do we face these wrong pressures? And what are wrong pressures? And I think one of those is the source of free information. You can hear and you can find everybody's opinion on any given subject. And somewhere along the line, you're going to have to figure out where the foundation is. What is the foundation? True, as we go through life, we need to make application There are scenarios that change, and this is one of them. Recently, our congregation, the last while, our congregation is going through our standard booklet, and really, it needed some updating. I really wish they'd had it all done before we got there. I really do. But there was one thing that came up was with our cars, no white wall tires. Now, who here knows anything about white wall tires? Do you see them? Oh, yeah, you see them on those old cars that we used to drive. But if you would go to a tire shop and say, I want white walls on this, I don't know, would they have them? I don't even know. And so, you know, there's things like that that had a point back then. And we do well to not, it was fine, your smiles about that question. But we do well to not make fun of the position that our predecessors chose to make and where to draw a line. Remember, young fellows and young ladies, that sometime in the future, you're going to be sitting, if the Lord tarries, where and in an audience where you are the elderly. And you will have to hear the younger generation saying, what was this all about? And you know what? Today, we must make application to what we face today. Because it isn't really a personal conviction of the congregation today. And we're going to have difficulty in doing, we're going to find ourselves doing just like that mother that come to the point where remarriage after divorce was not, there was nothing wrong with it. There was a viable excuse why you could do it. But the great difference is Bible doctrine that she was going against and teaching against rather than an application. I think that's important that we keep it clear, the difference between what is Bible doctrine and where we find ourselves today needing to make application to those doctrines. There is a question came to my mind as I thought about families facing wrong pressures. Is the attitude that we take towards those pressures. Now, what are those pressures? I really don't have to go into any detail what those pressures are. You well know them. But this is the angle, this is where I want to come from. How do you look at those pressures? The age-old story. And I don't know how often as a boy I read the story of David and Goliath many, many times. I remember when I was old enough to read and my parents gave me my first Bible. And that just helped a Sunday morning service go by so fast because I'd find these Bible stories and I'd read them. And it just seemed like it helped Sunday morning service go by so much faster. And it troubles me a little bit when I see parents bring their children to to church with these little golden books, and you know, that's just my opinion. And it's nothing to do with Christianity or anything. So, David and Goliath, what was the problem there? What was the scenario there? Here was this host of Israel sitting down. And here was Goliath, one man, standing in the field, defying the armies of the living God. How could that be? Was David's question. The difference was, Israel was in such a spiritual condition, depravity, that they looked at Goliath as a threat. And so they sit down. Nothing we can do about it. Bigger than we are. And so on. And completely forgot God in the whole scenario. Well, here comes David. And David, the shepherd boy, I'd rather think of him as a young man. David, as a young man, he was sent on an errand by his father to bring some things to his brothers that were part of the army of Israel. He gets there with these things, and brothers greet him, and David begins to sense that there's something wrong. There's a spirit here that's troubled. And he was like, well, what's going on? Well, they said, look at that Goliath. There's no one here that can fight him. And what Goliath was inviting was to fight man to man. And why couldn't Israel, as one man, have gone out there and taken care of him? Well, David says, well, and he inquired a little bit, and finally his older brother said, what are you doing here anyway? You're just here out of curiosity. You don't have any business here. And this is the verse in that whole chapter that stands out to me, has always stood out to me. David said, is there not a cause? Is there not a cause? Have you forgot? And the rebuke of his, I think the rebuke of his brother stung him, because he was not there out of curiosity. He was there on a mission for his father. And that was exactly what Israel had forgotten, that they were on a mission for their father in heaven. And rather they were looking at their father Saul, who had led them into the spiritual depravity that they were in. And Saul wasn't given any direction, because he had no word from God what to do. He had no connection with God at that time anymore. God had told him, you're rejected. I can no longer have you as king over my people. And I don't know why it went so many years, except that David went through a school that really did prepare him for being king of Israel. And God used that time, I think, to establish principles in David's life that made it that he was a man after God's own heart. He was the man that led Israel through many battles that were won. He was a man that established in Israel principles, kingship that God wanted them to have. He failed, but we'll leave that. That's not part of the subject. What was the difference? David looked at Goliath as a challenge, not a threat. And I believe that's the attitude that we need to take as Christians. Is there not a cause? Is there not a purpose that we're laboring and living and loving by? Isn't there something? Aren't there principles that we can follow? Doesn't the Word of God speak out on these subjects and give us direction? Maybe not specific points, but we have so many scriptures that give us the direction that we can use to find way in all this maze of information, criticism, just on and on and on. And if you want to listen, if you want to get confused, listen to it. And if you want to stay stay foundational, don't listen to it. There are so many ideas, so many thoughts on every subject that there is anymore. And a lot of it is merely comes from what is comfortable, what is popular, and sin doesn't matter. David, as he as he discerned what was going on, he said, "I'll go." And so Saul said, "Well, how? What do you know about battle?" Well, he said, "I killed a lion and a bear that was taking my sheep." Did that stand him in good stead to go out and fight this huge, giant with? I never can remember all the weight of his armor and his staff and all that stuff. It was just impressive and tremendous. But you know, that's all Goliath had was his size, his armor, creating fear in these simple folks over here of Israel. David saw Goliath as nothing more than the presence of a lion and a bear in his flock. Again, he said, is there not a cause? What is wrong here? He is defying the armies of the living God. And so what had happened? Saul had lost his connection with God because of disobedience. He looked for comfort. Saul wanted to be comfortable in his position. And instead of wiping out that people that he was, which one of the people was it? Is Amalek or so? I believe he said, "Well, because of the people, we didn't complete the order that God gave us." After all, he was king, and he could call the order. He was king. And so his popularity was more important than the truth that God had called him, told him to do. And it was easier to sin just a little bit against God's order than it was to simply surrender. This is what God has asked us to do. David went down to the brook. Saul tried to put on David his armor. All that, David said, "I don't know how to use these things. My trust is in God." He went down to the brook and chose 5 smooth stones. And he went out to meet Saul, Goliath. Not too sure. Just come to me. I think, doesn't it say somewhere that he ran to meet Goliath? Goliath in his great, big, bold voice, and all his armor and so on, made fun of this simple shepherd boy with nothing but a pouch and a sling in his hand, a pouch at his side and a sling in his hand. But Goliath had no clue, no idea, the power that was behind that one stone that found its spot in the most gullible place in his great armor was his forehead. That one stone found its place, and God's power was reestablished in a way that Israel couldn't do anymore because of being estranged from God. They had no messenger from God at that time. But David took one stone. And, it's just interesting. I often wonder, why did he choose five? Well, I think we read further that maybe Goliath had four more brothers. But just look at the difference. David took that as a challenge. With one stone, gained the victory for Israel. And who ran? All of Goliath's brothers and all the host of Philistines. They had nothing anymore. Goliath was their man. He was their power. And yet there was nothing behind it but a show. There was nothing behind it. And I'm sure the Philistines were sitting back there, just had all kinds of theories and so on and so forth, of the best way to have a battle. But they just turned it over to Goliath because of all his bravado. He could do what he wanted to. They could win the battle just by sitting there and letting this giant. So we need to look at the giants that present themselves in our lives as not a threat, but as a challenge. Finishing the story of David, 1 Kings 9. This is the word of the Lord to Solomon Solomon had become king. Solomon was an humble man at that time. And the Lord said unto him in verse 3, I have heard thy prayer and thy supplication that thou hast made before me. I have hallowed this house which thou hast built to put my name there forever, and mine eyes and mine heart shall be there perpetually. And if thou wilt walk before me as David thy father walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded thee, and wilt keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of my kingdom upon Israel forever, as I promised to David thy father, saying, there shall not fail thee a man upon the throne of Israel. But if ye shall at all turn from following me, ye or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I have given them, and this house which I have hallowed for my name will I cast out of my sight. Israel shall be a proverb and a byword among all people. I really don't know. As I consider this, and we know the history of Israel, I really don't understand why there are those that think that somehow, they can celebrate the Jewish nation back into favor with God. Look at what this says here. Now, you can read all the prophecies and make all the applications and put things together, and I can't do that personally. I've heard individuals, but somehow it doesn't make sense when you read what God told Israel, that if you do this, this is what happens. God did favor Israel time throughout the coming kings and so on. There were those that remembered God to a certain point. Some of them said they served God, but they didn't do this. They didn't remove all the high places or all the altars and one thing after other until the final end came when they were carried away to Babylon. Exactly, and there they were for 70 years, exactly the way God said it would be. So, where do we find ourselves? Do we look at all these things that are pressuring us? And do we maybe ask for some of the pressure that we get? I don't know. As a threat, when we look at things as a threat, we tend to react. And reacting tends to close the door. We react and we don't want anything to do with it. We slam the door shut. We're not going to have it. We're not going to consider it. And is that really the way we want to do? Is that the answer to the situation? Just isolating ourselves, as it were, from facing up to something that begins to pressure us? When in facing it, or in doing this, it results in losing an opportunity. When we find it easier to say no, rather than giving and considering, this is a challenge. What are our reasons? Why not? Or why should we? As a threat, it creates negative motivation. Where was the whole host of Israel in all this? Yeah, Goliath said, send me a man. But why didn't they say, here we are as a man? Here we are, a unified people under God's order. Here we are, here we come. I really think if they would have all rushed out there as one man, Goliath would have turned and run. Because he had nothing. So as a result was, Israel's faith in God was way too small, and they couldn't see anything beyond this threat. If there's something I should add to this or something I should consider differently, I'm open. Now let's think of facing something as a challenge. There's a whole lot more, likely more thoughts we could consider as a threat. But I want to turn this to where it's positive. A challenge. Number one, a challenge calls for an exercise of faith. We don't always know where a decision we make can lead us. But if it calls for a decision, someone has to speak up and declare where our loyalties are. That's exactly what David did. He stepped out. It was an exercise of faith. He trusted God. He knew how God had been with him in the time past, and he was totally loyal to the people of Israel. Is there not a cause? And so when we consider it from the standpoint of a challenge, it clarifies the course. We're not just reacting, slamming the door shut. We're not even going to consider it and so on. But it clarifies the course. It pulls out from the Word of God, establishes the course that we need to take for ourselves and our children. And like it or not, it sets boundaries. And a challenge defines our perception. A challenge dares us to action. And all these strengthens our vision. As one becomes older, you look back on your life and consider things and times that you were called to these challenges, situations called for establishing boundaries, clarifying the course, gaining a clear perception of what was needed and so on, the call to action, and what established your vision, it creates in one a deeper appreciation for what others have done for us in the past. And so that's why it's so important that we consider those things. How have churches, church groups, found themselves in condition of apostasy? Not in one big step, but probably many little ones. My grandfather was Church of the Brethren, never become Mennonite. My grandmother was Mennonite. And back in that time, there was a lot of relating back and forth between Mennonite churches and Church of the Brethren, because at one point there wasn't that much difference between them. But when they became obsessed with higher education, the Church of the Brethren became obsessed with higher education, how important it was for have degrees and so on, it was a downward course. And I think, as my father viewed his cousins, he did not have very many cousins. I don't know, was it 5 or 6, something like that? Because at that time going to EMC and so on, the higher education had become like an obsession to him, and careers and all that thing, and families weren't that important. And I've thought already, as I considered, we hardly had any connection with the extended Petrie family. We moved to Actually, when we moved to Tennessee out of the Washington County, Franklin County area, we learned to know our great uncles and aunts better than we did living there because they came to visit us. Now, my father's cousins, I don't remember if any did, but there were doctors and I'm not sure what all. And yes, inevitably, the divorce and remarriage came up with all that higher education and they were just a whole lot more better informed, you know. And so I wondered at times, but there were other things that kind of set a course for my father as he in our upbringing that we didn't really understand at the time, and my father struggled with sometimes probably you could say respect for authorities he should have, but there was one thing that he could hardly abide was inconsistency in authority, which led us to move away from where we were living in Washington County, Franklin County area, and eventually led us to Sparta, Tennessee. But I remember coming under the deeper teaching and so on, there had to be some recognition made that we had a little bit wrong concept of authority. And there was a coming out of that, and that's where I would rather stop with that right now. So as we consider the choices that are made and parents helping their youth as they face these influences, these pressures, I believe there's one thing that's so important, and that is the relationship of parents with their children. That children feel the affirmation of their parents for their whole life. Until they make the decision to begin their own homes, and then that circle starts again, that cycle continues, you might say. No, it not starts again. That cycle continues, and new families are established, and God says that that a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. And there's a time when parents have to step back. You might say allow the fruits of their teaching program to expose itself through this new home. But as children and youth, as they face these pressures, it's important that we relate to our children in a way. They may be new fronts, but it's the same old enemy. I can't accept it when I hear the thought that you don't understand what the problem is today. No, I don't understand all the mechanics of technology. I don't. And I really don't need to. But at the same time, for me to just shut the door on and say I don't need any of it isn't really facing reality. So our children need to feel that we relate to them in a way that helps them to have a self-worth. And when I say that, I am not saying anything about egoism or anything like that. But the children know that Dad and Mom care for the pressures that they feel in their life. And young people, you can create the scenario, you can make the scenario much worse by just not listening to the voice of experience. Ephesians speaks of fathers provoking not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Provoking your children to wrath. I really don't think, my opinion is that that scripture is not speaking of treating your children in a way that makes them angry, but rather treating them in a way that that makes them reject, makes them react. Because we haven't properly dealt with the situation, faced the situation as we should, and not been able to transfer to them a reason and a purpose for it, and so they just reject. There's so much of that done today, so much of it happening. Another thing with all this free information is, I want you to think about this, your word usage. If you would go to Webster's Dictionary and look up the way you're using that word, what would it say? What would Webster say? The language usage, the way people have come to express themselves and for me, something that was just a normal way to express myself or ask a question, somebody said, you don't ask that question that way anymore. It's suggestive. I said, by the way Webster's Dictionary puts it, there's nothing wrong with the way I'm saying this. I can't help that society has put a vulgar meaning to it. And that gets a little bit frustrating. I don't have to change my vocabulary. If I'm using proper word usage, I don't have to change my vocabulary because social media has chose to make a general statement, something that's corrupt. So let's consider these pressures. The words we use, do we really want it to have that connotation? I came right smack up against it one time with this young lady sitting here on the bench. It's my granddaughter, and I love her very much. She started using the word, and her daddy asked her one day, why are you using that word? Well, Grandpa does. And you know what? I quit using that word, at least when she was around. But I quit using that word. And so some of these four-letter words, I don't think they should be in our vocabulary one bit. That is out there. Because the scripture says, let your speech be seasoned with salt. Let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay. So, already touched on this a little bit, but parental relationships. So ought a man leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. And that is the relationship that our children need to see from the day they have any concept of parental relationships. That father loves mother, and mother loves father. And to play between them is dangerous. Play between them is dangerous. To go to dad and ask for permission to do something, he says no. And to go to mom and ask for permission to do the same thing, and mom hasn't quite realized what was going on, she says yes. But when dad and mom come together and find out what happens, there's danger there. That our children need to see honor, respect between husband and wife, father and mother. And it will create in them, I'm not making a blanket statement, but it will create in them a desire to be obedient. Oh, we deal with the carnal nature. That's not going to be for always, but in every situation. But I'm convinced that it does. When children can see that the parental relationship is such, it's intact, it's true. Why can't we respect our parents? Why can't we be obedient to them? It's a desire that they have. Another pressure is interfamily relationships. That's my family relating to yours. Things can happen. Our children have the carnal nature. Things can happen. But if we're going to stand in a carnal, evil society, parents, you're going to have to respect other parents' decision where they decide to say no. To respect their perimeters. They might not be what yours are. But if your children begin to tell my children, that doesn't matter. Your parents are just old fogies. That creates a dangerous situation also. I cannot abide that. And in the long run, parents, if you do that, your children will come to the place they won't respect you either. Another one. Maybe you've been expecting this, but materialism and affluence. The pressures of materialism and affluence. What is important? What do we teach our children as important in life? I appreciate when youth, they come to adulthood. I'm not saying as a platform, but 21 years of age, it's a time when they can experience some voluntary service. It's not necessary that a young man at 21 be pushed out and it's all yours, you make your own money. And immediately he has to buy a car, he has to buy a truck, and so we have to pay these things, and it goes on and on. Pretty soon he's a rich young man with no interest in voluntary service. Voluntary service is the answer to all ills, isn't the answer to all every need in life, but there is something about, and I learned voluntary service, even though I never really went into that. Went somewhere, served in for Christian Aid Ministry somewhere as a voluntary service. But I tell you what, my voluntary service often was. As a young fellow, my grandfather built a new house. It was their retirement house. And one day he came and picked my two older brothers and I up to help him rake his new lawn so he could seed it down. And immature and foolish as I was kind of calculating, you know, maybe he'd give us a $10 bill, at least. Well, no reflection on my grandfather, that was not his way at all. But I learned that I could help my grandfather in his elder years prepare his lawn, rake it down to be able to seed it, and I didn't need to be paid 1 cent for that. We had neighbors. That was back when we were farmers. And our neighbors sometimes were called away and needed someone to do their chores. I never thought of charging my neighbor to do his chores. Now, it was kind of nice if he slipped me a $20 bill after it was all over, but at the same time, to charge him for that, no. Maybe that's why I'm poor today, I don't know. But at the same time, now, this is what I deal with. And I'm not celebrating this. I have cousins my age that are in their retirement. Their sons have farms paid for. But I tell you what I have, or we have. 20 years of voluntary service in Central America. 20 years. I wouldn't trade for anything. I'd like to conclude with Psalm 127. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gates. And we could enlarge on this psalm. I think we'll close with that. Shall we kneel in prayer?